Blog Talk Radio.
Gentlemen, and welcome to the Eastern Airlines Radio Show. Thank you for being with us tonight. And do you know that tonight is our 3,420th program? In other words, I think it's a bit more than just 3 years. We start talking about Eastern Airlines every Monday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on your computers, Internet Network, www.ealradioshow.com or at www.blogtalkradio.com/ Captain Eddie, E-D-D-I-E. The host for the radio show, we are from so many different locations. Wait a minute now. South, North, and Central Florida, North Carolina, New York City area, Pennsylvania, and on occasion, me, when I'm on the island of Martha's Vineyard. Before we introduce our host, our producer, and appropriate musical interlude for the show tonight. How about that, Mr. Producer?
Yes, sir, Jim. I wish we had done 3,000 shows, but we're actually in our 157th episode, and in this episode tonight, we think you'll really enjoy it. I've chosen a musical sound clip that you may recognize, or if you do not, I will tell you about it at the end of the music. Fate is a Hunter is a 1964 film about the crash of an airliner and the subsequent investigation. It was directed by Ralph Nelson and released by 20th Century Fox. It was nominally based on the best-selling 1961 novel, Fate is a Hunter, by Ernest Gann. The story, just briefly, is about pilot Jack Savage, who is suspected of drinking and causing an airliner crash that kills 53 people and leaves only a single survivor. Martha Webster, a flight attendant, is the captain's wartime is in the movie. The captain's wartime buddy, airline executive Sam McBain, is convinced of his friend's innocence and investigates doggedly. Flashbacks deal with both Jack's past and Sam meeting him, plus others they used to know. And in the cast of that movie was Glenn Ford, who played as Sam McBain, Nancy Kwan as Sally Frazier, Rod Taylor as the captain, Jack Savage, Suzanne Flazette as Martha Webster, and Jane Russell made an appearance as a guest star. And it had several other actors like Wally Cox and Max Showalter, and Dorothy Malone was in the movie. It was a great movie. The movie itself, the Consolidated Airways jet aircraft that was used in the film, was one of two fabricated from a DC-7B that was donated, and the second was used to create the crash scene on the beach. The wings were reportedly removed and reversed. A Boeing 707 nose cone, along with supersonic spike, were also added in order to achieve the appearance of a modern jet airliner. Modifications to the rear section of the aircraft included the addition of two nacelles to accommodate the simulated jet engines and a rear-mounted Boeing 707 spike-style HF antenna isolator. An antenna were also added to the tail sections. An area of the 20th Century Fox back lot was converted into the tarmac taxiway and runway seen in that film. Because of the fear of litigation, it was reported that no airframe manufacturer or airline was willing to cooperate in the production of the film, making these steps necessary. The fate of the Hunter aircraft was later used in the filming of an episode of the ABC television series Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea. So the movie had quite an impact on films that were produced even later than the music and the motion picture 1964 of Fate is a Hunter. There is some controversy about Ernest Gann's approval of that movie, but you might want to pick that up on the internet and listen to it. But the music score was beautifully arranged by Mr. Goldstein. I would like to introduce our host tonight for our broadcast. I am here in Jacksonville, Florida, and the Ponte Vedra area, halfway between Jacksonville and St. Augustine, Florida. And we have had a rainy day all day today, and that's okay. We need water. I'll never complain about rain again. I'm a homeowner. I hope very soon, because our home is almost completed and the grass needs water. But we do have with us tonight George Jenn, and we called him our official Yankee living in New York. And George, how are things out on the island, Long Island that is? George?
Well, actually, today it started out pretty bad, but this evening, it's absolutely gorgeous, and I understand that the rest of the week, the weather's going to be nice, and I believe, I hate to say it on St. Patty's Day, but I believe that the bad weather is over for the season now. If anyone was watching the St. Patrick's Day parade today on the television, you could see that it was really cold this morning and this afternoon, but right now it's warmed up quite a bit, and it's supposed to be very nice for the rest of the week. So hopefully winter is taking its last bite at the Northeast.
You know, George, I think everybody in the world are Irish on this day. I don't care what nationality or culture or wherever you are. Green is the color for the day, and everyone likes to celebrate St. Patrick's Day. I wonder why that is. It must be the beer. But
I think it is.
Yeah. Chuck Albright, you're in the land of golf, and tell us again how many golf courses in your area. I still don't believe you, Chuck.
I'll send you some verification. We have 52 golf courses. 12 of them are championship courses, and the rest of them are more nine-hole golf courses. We have about 13 country clubs now, and we're topping out at about 125,000 people, and it looks like they're going to finish 56,000 homes. So we're kind of a pretty big, we're the biggest retirement center in the world. Today we had some of your rain. It just rained all day. I had to cancel my golf thing with my buddy today, which was very disappointing. And right now it's looking like it's about 61 degrees, and we still had some thunderstorms coming up here later on this evening. But tomorrow it's going to lighten up a little bit, and maybe by the end of the week we can get back out on the golf course. Back to you.
Okay, very good. Thanks a lot, Chuck. And
Anytime. Just downstream
of Jim Hart, who is in Palm Beach, is the lovely Cecile Intriago. Cecile, how are things just a little south of PBI?
Hi, it is very hot. It was in the 80s today, and a friend went to the beach over the week on Los Olas Boulevard, where it's near the Elbow Room, which was filmed. And they said it was bumper-to-bumper spring breakers. So it must be early out of college, and it was very, very crowded on the beaches. Very windy today also, extremely windy.
Okay, thanks a lot, Cecile. How's Charles getting along? Has he done any fishing lately?
As a matter of fact, he'll be here in a few minutes. I can tell you when he gets here, but he's going to go fishing Thursday. I think they're going to try to catch some sail.
Okay, very good. Thanks a lot. Okay, up in Philadelphia, I'm sure by now, John Ruth, the snow must have melted. So how are things coming along, and do you have any travel alerts for us tonight?
Well, we had snow this morning, and it was cold and miserable most of the day, but it has cleared up. I hope, like George said, that it's the end of it, because I've had quite enough for 1 year. And the travel website is up and running and fully functional, both the EAL Travel Club and TravelingSquad.com. We've got deals everywhere in the world. There's sales on everything, so now's the time to book it. So you just go to www.flyeastern.com. That's fly-eastern.com, just like the old advertising moniker. And you'll find anywhere you want to go in the world where there's sunshine and surf and beach and golf, we've got it.
Very good. Well, that leaves just for us to tell you how to get in touch with us tonight if you'd like to call in. We have a great show tonight for you because we've got two reports. One that was of a tragic accident of Eastern Airlines back in the 60s, and then we have a person that was involved indirectly about that. So we'll start our program in just a second. But if you'd like to call us tonight about your thoughts of anything, even the show tonight or just anything that you'd like to comment, please do so. And you can reach us at area code 213-816-1611. Again, let me repeat that. Area code 213-816-1611. And if you'd call us toll-free, you can reach us at area code 877-572-1861. Again, I'll repeat that number. 877-572-1861. Now, when you call that number, remember, if your name appears on our board, we see you there, then all you need to do is to press number 1 on your keypad of your telephone, and that will alert our producer, which is yours truly, talking right now, to the fact that you'd like to tell us something or comment on what we've talked about tonight. So it'll be a red flag there, and we'll open up the microphone for you. It's very simple. So join us if you would, please. Our show tonight is along the theme song of Fate is a Hunter, because I truly believe there was a lot of fate in the program that we present to you tonight. The show is an actual accounting of a real-life experience by one of our hosts and Eastern Flight 633. Steve, will you start our program tonight?
Yes, thank you, Neil. It begins in 1957, which was a very meaningful year in my life. And my wife, Glenda, and I were married in June, and I was hired by Eastern in July. Then we moved to New York in September. Later in 1959, in my career with Eastern, we moved to Charlotte, and our first child was born in November of that year. Two other children were born in Charlotte in 61 and 63. The Charlotte base was a very... Pardon me for just one second. The Charlotte base was a real family-oriented, close-knit group. We met close friends like Ray Meadows, John Wink, Bill Jackson, Chuck Wright, and their families, just to name a few. My sister Lynn and her husband lived nearby and babysat for us and were close to the children. Since we had a loyal housekeeper, Glenn and I decided to take a 5-day trip to Mexico City on February 3, 1965. Our housekeeper moved into our house to take care of the children until we returned on February the 8th. We had a wonderful trip, but were anxious to get back to our children. Our return trip had us leaving Mexico City with a stop in New Orleans, then nonstop to JFK, Kennedy Airport, where we were to connect with Flight 663 to Richmond and then on to Charlotte. According to our scheduled arrival time and departure time, we had an hour and 30 minutes on the ground at JFK. Cecile.
Eastern Airlines Flight 663 was a scheduled domestic passenger flight from Boston, Massachusetts to Atlanta, Georgia, with scheduled stopovers at New York International Airport, which at that time was known as Idlewild Airport. It's now known as John F. Kennedy International Airport. And it was going to New York, Richmond, Virginia, Charlotte, North Carolina, and Greenville, South Carolina. On the night of February 8, 1965, the aircraft serving the flight, a DC-7, took off from New York's John F. Kennedy International Airport with 79 passengers and 5 crew members on board. Chuck?
The Douglas DC-7 serving Flight 663 made its first flight in 1958. It had subsequently accumulated a total of 18,500 hours of flight time. It was piloted by Captain Frederick R. Carlson. He was 41. He had been employed by Eastern Airlines for 19 years, and he who had accumulated 12,670 flight hours. His co-pilot, First Officer Edward R. Durham, 41, a 9-year veteran of Eastern Airlines, had 8,550 hours of flight time. The flight engineer was Douglas C. Mitchell. He was 24. With 2 years employment and 407 pilot hours and 141 hours flight engineer time, all had passed their proficiency check with the DC-7B aircraft. The two flight attendants aboard were Linda Lord and Judith Durkin. Steve?
Well, our flight out of New Orleans to JFK Kennedy was on time, and en route, instead of the usual westerly winds, we would have had a tailwind. We encountered a headwind, resulting in our arriving 30 minutes late at the Idlewild Airport. We now have 1 hour to get through customs and get to the gate for our Charlotte flight. As soon as we arrive in customs at the International Arrival Building, Glenda called my sister in Charlotte to tell her we'd be on flight 663 from Kennedy to Charlotte. John.
Meanwhile, flight 663 from Logan International Airport in Boston, Massachusetts to New York's Idlewild International Airport proceeded normally. Steve?
We now start the customs clearing procedure, which had us claiming our bags, going through immigration, and then clearing customs. The procedure took an unusually long time because there were so many international arrivals at this time of the day. And when we finished, we had only 30 minutes to board the bus out front, go around to all of the terminal buildings, and get to our gate at the Eastern Terminal Building. Well, I was still confident we could make it until we got to the TWA terminal on a one-way, single-car drive where someone had left their car in the driveway and prevented us from getting through or backing out. So we sat for 15 minutes until the car was moved. We're now down to 15 minutes to departure time for the flight back to Charlotte on flight 663. John.
And the passenger boarding call for Eastern Flight 633 is made so that an on-time departure from the gate can be maintained. Steve?
We go around to the other terminal building and finally get to the Eastern Terminal with only 5 minutes to door closing. We hurriedly get our bags and run through the terminal building to the gate just in time to see the flight pulling away from the gate. John?
And Flight 663 departed Idlewild at 6:20 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time on an instrument flight plan to Byrd Field, now Richmond International Airport in Richmond, Virginia. Takeoff proceeded normally, and the airport control tower prepared to hand over control to New York Air Route Traffic Control Center on Long Island, noting that Flight 663 was executing a Dutch 7 departure, a routine takeoff procedure that required a series of turns over the Atlantic Ocean in order to avoid flying over New York City. The New York Air Route Traffic Control Center responded with the information that Pan American Airways Flight 212, a Boeing 707, was descending to 4,000 feet in the same airspace. George?
The night of February 8th was dark, with no visible moon or stars, and no discernible horizon. As the two airliners approached similar positions, their pilots had no points of reference with which to determine the actual separation distance or position of the flights. Flight 663's departure turn and Pan Am's subsequent turn left to its assigned heading, had placed the two aircraft on the illusion of a direct collision course. The Boeing Pan Am Clipper 212 rolled right and initiated a descent in an attempt to avoid a collision. In response, Eastern 663 initiated an extreme right turn in order for the aircraft to pass by each other safely. The captain of Pan Am 212 later estimated that the two aircraft had passed between 200 and 500 feet from each other, while the first officer estimated that the distance was only 200 to 300 feet. The following radio transmissions between New York Air Traffic Control Center and JFK Control Tower were as follows. Neil?
All right. At 3 miles of Dutch intersection is Clipper 212, descending to 4,000. How does he shape up with that boy coming in? Let's see. The guy is at his 1 o'clock position. Well,
we're above him.
The control tower
responded Flight 663 was at a higher altitude than Flight 212. It was, in fact, lower. Subsequently, the control tower radioed the Pan Am flight. There was traffic in his airspace at 11 o'clock, 6 miles away, traveling southeast of Pan Am's position, climbing above 3,000 feet. Pan Am 212 acknowledged ATC, then radioed Flight 663 a similar advisory at 2 o'clock, 5 miles away, traveling below Flight 663's position. In reality, the traffic, Pan Am 212, was above Flight 663, descending from 5,000 feet. Captain Carlson acknowledged that he saw the traffic and that it was he was beginning to turn into the Dutch 7 departure and signing off saying good night. George?
Flight 663 was unable to recover from its unusually steep bank and plunged into the icy waters of the Atlantic Ocean, where it exploded with bright orange flames. The Pan Am 707 was the first to relay the news of the crash as it was receiving permission to land. Air Canada Flight 627, which had departed a few minutes prior to Flight 663, also radioed the news of an explosion in the water. Neil?
Okay, we had a near miss here. We're turning now to 360, and did you have another target in this area, the same spot where we were just a minute ago?
Affirmative, however, not on my scope at the present time.
Is he still on the scope?
No, sir.
Well, it looks like he's in the bay then, because we saw him. We looked like he looked like he winged over to miss us, and we tried to avoid him, but we saw a bright flash about 1 minute later. He was well above the top of us, and it looked like he went into an absolute vertical turn and kept rolling.
New York Air Canada Flight 627, there's a big fire going out on the water here about to our 2 o'clock position right now. I don't know what it is. It looked like a big explosion. And after the initial explosion, the wrecked aircraft sank to the bottom of 75 feet of water. Numerous air crews, including Pan Am Flight 212, Air Canada 627, and Braniff Airlines Flight 5, radioed ATC controllers in the area with news of an explosion. The aircraft broke up on impact and was destroyed. All 5 crew members and 79 passengers died on impact.
Steve?
Well, I upon arriving at the gate that we had just missed the flight, I asked the agent if we had been on time, would there have been seats for us? And he replied that there was. But also that there was another flight to Charlotte from Newark, that and we could pass ride on the helicopter leaving from JFK to Newark in about 30 minutes. Well, we arrived at Newark from the helicopter and noticed that all Eastern personnel were in a very somber mood. We handed our passes to one of the agents working the Charlotte flight, and his comment to us was, well, it's a good thing you were not on Flight 663 out of Kennedy. And I asked why, and he said, well, it went into the ocean just off Kennedy, and everyone was killed. Now, we immediately called my sister, who had just seen a TV news special about 2 hours before that the flight had crashed and all aboard had perished. Now, she expected us to be on that flight since we called her from when we arrived at Kennedy in New York. Well, she was beside herself now with relief, whereas before, believing that the flight on the flight in her mind, we were on the flight in her mind, and she had been making plans to raise our children. Not until we heard the news did we fully understand, as the words of the title in a Ernest Gann novel, Fate is a Hunter, just how a matter of circumstances, sometime beyond our control, life is balanced on a thin edge. George.
The aftermath and investigation and subsequent investigation, 15 ships accompanied by 11 helicopters and numerous rescue divers converged on the scene of the crash in hopes of rendering aid to survivors. 2 hours after impact, debris began floating up to the surface. By sunrise, 7 bodies had been recovered. 3 more were discovered in the course of the following 3 days. In locating the wreckage, the United States Navy provided underwater sonar to assist with the operation. 13 Coast Guard vessels helped searching the shores of Long Island and provided salvage efforts. Rescue workers and volunteers scoured 40 miles of beaches, collecting debris that washed ashore. The Civil Aeronautics Board, the CAB, investigated the accident. the DC-7 was not required to be equipped with a flight recorder, which would have automatically recorded the pilot's every control input. Thus, the CAB was forced to rely upon witnesses' testimony, radio recordings, and a best guess based upon experience. Nevertheless, the CAB determined that the evasive maneuvers undertaken by the pilot of Eastern Flight 663 in order to avoid the oncoming Pan Am jet caused spatial disorientation. The disorientation, coupled with the extreme maneuver, made it impossible for the pilots to recover from the roll in a few seconds remaining before the DC-7 crashed into the Atlantic Ocean. The CAB also determined that Captain Carson had neither the time nor adequate information to assess Eastern Flight 663's position relative to Pan Am 212, and, given the illusion of a collision course, he had acted appropriately in initiating evasive maneuvers. The CAB made no recommendations in the final accident report. Although early news reports reported the near miss of Flight 663 and 212, the FAA denied that there was ever any danger of a collision. Cecile?
At that time, the crash of Flight 663 was unfortunately the fifth worst aviation accident to have occurred in the United States. It was and remains the third deadliest crash of a DC-7. That's after Caledonian Airways Flight 153 and Northwest Airlines Flight 293, and is the 25th deadliest single-plane accident to have occurred in the United States.
Well, there are times when we all have life close calls that shape our lives. And this was truly one of those for my wife, children, family, and myself. In thinking about this event and reflecting on other events in my life, I have to ask, why me, Lord? So many times like this event, my life was spared because of things happening that were illogical at times that caused my life to be spared. So many of these events have taken place that I was spared because of circumstances within themselves which seemed illogical. Such was the case in Flight 855. Now, one of the first ones that I remember was driving home late at night when I was in college from Asheville to Batcave. I had just gone through a 5-mile straightaway when I ran across a lady who was standing out in the middle of the road with a white dress and a white dress that was road length, surface length. And I had to apply my brakes forcefully to avoid hitting a lady standing in the middle of the road wearing a road-length white dress. I stopped the car and I got out to see if I had hit her, but there was no one around. I had stopped the car just before it went over the side of the road. I had fallen asleep. And I believe that God has spared me for some purpose that I'm not aware of, but I need to continue the search. Now, my family has urged me to write a book of these events, and I have started it. The book is tentatively named My Guardian Angels. Neil?
Well, I certainly appreciate the show tonight, and Steve, especially you coming forth with the idea, but your life experience of this flight, this particular flight. And because it involved Eastern Flight 663, I thought it would be a good idea to put this into a broadcast production. And thank you very much, host, because you've delivered a good show tonight. And I hate to call it a show, but a life experience tonight of two different sources here. One from a person that as Ernest Gann would say, fate is the hunter. What an apropos title for a book and for a movie, fate is the hunter. The way I listened to the presentation of this show, Steve, had that car not have blocked your access to getting to the gate, what difference that would have made? Fate is a hunter. Any types of things that would involve you just missing by a second or a minute or an hour, what difference that would have made? And Fate is a Hunter again. And Ernie Gann, in his book, Fate is a Hunter, had a lot of different incidents that had it not been for the circumstances, the results would have been different. And I've had those, and I'm sure our listeners have had those, and our hosts have had those experiences themselves. And I recall, and I've mentioned it on the broadcast in the past, a 757 and I had a flight out of San Jose, Costa Rica to Miami, and had just a second difference it would have made in that I wouldn't be talking on this microphone tonight had it not happened. So fate is the hunter. Any of you guys that are listening tonight, our host or our listeners, would like to share in any event in your life that you could say, yes, fate is a hunter.
Neil, it's George. I can go a little bit further than that. In 1984, I flew down to Miami for a retirement party for someone we probably all know, Whitey John, who was an old friend of the family. And after the party, I decided, well, I was going to drive up to Palm Beach to see a friend of mine and his wife from Germany who were living up there. So I hopped in my rental car and got about as far as Fort Lauderdale, and I said, well, you know what? I had been up early that morning. I said, now I'm kind of tired. So I got on a side road, a side highway. Don't hold me to the number. I think it was 826, though. And long story short, I fell asleep at the wheel and crashed into a bridge abutment at about 60 miles an hour in my rental car. And the next thing I recall was I was on top of the car looking down, and one of the ambulance attendants who had pulled up picked up my arm and said, was checking for a pulse, and he said, no, leave him, he's dead. And the other attendant said, well, let's put him in the ambulance. Perhaps we could get a pulse. And the next thing I recall, I was in a tunnel. It was like a gray tunnel, like if you had been almost knocked out, but not at all like that. It was beautiful, and it was very warm, and there was a bright light at the end of it. And that's where I was going, to the light. And the next thing I knew, I was standing in front of a friend of mine, a very close friend of mine, who had passed away about 4 years before that from, he had childhood diabetes. And I looked at him, and I really didn't speak because I didn't have to speak, but I said, here I am. And he looked at me, and he said, no, go back, George. It's not your time yet. And I woke up. It was the next evening. I was in the hospital in Fort Lauderdale on a life support system, and I got to tell you, Eastern flew my wife down, and my father-in-law and my brother-in-law, and Tom Butchen was sitting on the end of my bed when I came to. And that was kind of raised a lot of questions in my mind about what it's really about here, believe me.
Yeah.
That brings chills. George,
yeah,
thank you for
sure
that.
Does. Yeah.
Well, it still does for me, too, to this day, and it's changed my life in so many different ways that I couldn't even imagine to relate to how I would relate the host of changes that have taken place. Perhaps all the things that, you know, we think are important become less important, and the things that we take for granted become much more important. And you might think, well, it must have been terrible. You died, but it was the absolute best thing that had ever happened to me. In fact, the hospital called my wife and told her, you know, you better get down here. We had to revive him twice, and we don't think he's going to be alive when you get here. And, I mean, it must have been a great ride for her for that 3 hours, you know. But it was actually the most wonderful thing that ever happened to me. It was just unbelievable.
Neil?
Yes, Cecilia?
There's a movie coming out soon. I can't remember exact name of it, but I think it starts with Heaven. And it's exact story that was just told of people seeing the light and how they come back. And it's, I think it's told by the eyes of an 8-year-old boy or something like that. It's coming out in the next 90 days. So a lot of people have said that they have seen exactly what was just described. And it's very interesting.
Did you say the name of the movie, Cecile? Would you give us that?
No, I'll look it up and I'll try to get it before we go off the air.
Okay, very good. I think all of us have experienced a moment that we recall and we reflect back to, you know, what if? What if to me is Fate as a Hunter? Because I was hired by Korean Airlines years ago, after Eastern shut down, and I went out and went through their medical. I went through the simulator check. By the way, the simulator check was down in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. I passed that. However, because of my blood sugar, Korean Airlines decided not to take me on as an employee. So therefore, I was not given a job with Korean Airlines. However, because of that, I contribute the fact that I'm alive today. Because had Korean Airlines decided that they would hire me, I would not have known when I came back to where I was living, the fact that I had cancer. And I probably would not have survived the cancer, the type of cancer I had. So Fate is a Hunter in the fact that, thank God, Korean Airlines turned me down, and later it was discovered that I had cancer. And I survived, and that was 20 years ago. So Fate is a Hunter. So I've always liked the Ernest Gann novel that he wrote, and he wrote several good books that eventually turned into movies, such as High and the Mighty, and I contribute that movie as being the reason that I wanted to become an airline pilot, and that movie came out in 1955. But Fate is a Hunter was a great book, and I recommend a reading by anyone listening to our broadcast tonight. Any comments by our host? Well, how about let's giving some thought to the Malaysian aircraft act. We've heard so much broadcast every hour, it seems like all day long. Even at 3 o'clock in the morning when I wake up and turn the TV on, I can't go to sleep, and I turn the TV on, and they're talking about Malaysian Air Flight 370. And we've heard so many different stories about that the disappearance of that Boeing 777 that we've all, I think, by now formulated an idea or an opinion as to what really happened on that flight. Any discussion about Flight 370, I think it's called, Malaysian Flight 370?
Neil, this is John. As you know, my position on that, and I know that there's other ideas, but you just don't lose a 777 into nowhere. I mean, it's an airplane that weighs 600,000 pounds, has all the latest navigation and communications gear on board, is capable of flying for 7,000 or 8,000 miles, and somebody had a plan, and I think executed that plan very artfully, and I don't think that airplane landed anywhere. I think it's the bottom of the ocean somewhere, but where we don't know.
You know, John, from the very beginning, when we found out that an aircraft was lost, we immediately thought of a terrorist and a bomb. Have you guys, our host, have you guys changed your opinion over the, 10 days now, 7 or 8, 9, 10 days, whatever it is, since we first heard that that flight was missing? Have you changed your mind by what you have heard? Anyone?
I don't think it was a terrorist bomb because the plane has made too many deviations. The plane, they deliberately moved the plane on different vectors. I mean, if it was a terrorist and it was a bomb, why would you wait and fly 4 hours to put this thing in the drink? You could have easily put it in the drink going over to, I think Vietnam was the airspace they were going into, and put the plane down in the water there. I truly believe it went north. I got that feeling from every, because I've been watching CNN constantly, and I just can't understand and the idea that this plane made so many vector turns and so many altitude changes deliberately, and then of course they shut the transponders off and stuff, and that was done deliberately. I mean, I have to agree to with everybody else to a certain degree that the plane is only going to fly so long and then it's going to run out of gas. But that plane could run all the way to fly to India with the gas that it had in it. So, and they haven't found, of course, the Indian Ocean and every place out there is a big place. And they have lots of aircraft and ships and even satellites looking for this debris and stuff. And then, and some of the places there in the ocean are quite deep. I think one of the trenches is like 12,000 feet. So if this plane even looked like it came close to getting down to the water into one piece or a couple of pieces, you wouldn't get a lot of that debris for a while, I wouldn't think. But there had to be something. Yeah. I think it went north. That's my personal opinion, but it could be proved wrong.
Neil,
yes,
this
Cecile.
Is Cecile here. Okay, I have just one thing on the Malaysian air crash. Our prayers are with the families that are suffering so much, and I hope something is found out soon for them. The name of that book that I was talking about, it's a book, and I think the name of the movie will probably be the same, but I couldn't swear to that, is Heaven is for Real. It's a little boy's outstanding story of his trip to heaven and back, and it was written by Todd Burpo with Lynn Vincent. So the name of the book is Heaven is for Real. And on a positive note, Charlie just walked in, and he can tell you a whole bunch of fishing things right now if you want to hear that.
Oh, sure.
Would you like? Okay.
Oh, yeah, let's change our discussion altogether and listen to Charlie. Charlie?
Okay, hold on.
Hey, guys, for the Dolphin.
Hey,
let me tell
good to hear from you, Charlie. Go ahead and tell us your fishing stories.
Well, everything's been heating up down here. A buddy of mine called me on Tuesday to go fishing. No, last Thursday. I couldn't make it. He said, listen, he says, got my lines on. He called me at 8 in the morning. Why you call me at 8 in the morning? I'm working. He goes, well, I just want to let you know we got two 30-pound dolphins in a box and a sailfish release, and we don't even have all our lines out yet. So the fishing's really heating up. A lot of good-sized dolphin being caught. Sails are popping in this wind. The guys are getting their kites up. And it's been good turnaround here. So if anybody wants to wet a line, it's probably a good time to do it if they got a boat big enough to buffer some of these winds.
Do you hear that, George?
I hear you. I'm headed out of town in about 10 days now.
And I'll tell you, a friend of mine sent me an email today. I got two of them. One of them, about a 1,500-pound blue marlin. It looks like it was caught off Hawaii. It is bigger than the freaking boat. It's awesome. But what was really cool is off of Los Sueños, I guess a couple of weeks ago, they caught and released about a 300-pound albino blue marlin. I got pictures of it. It is totally white. It really looks weird, but it's such an oddity. They'll see an albino sailfish once in a while, but I don't know if I've ever seen a picture of an albino blue marlin. It was really cool.
Oh. Okay. All right. That's our fishing report.
I'll put you back to see it. Hold on.
That's our fishing report for tonight. But guys and listeners, I hope you've enjoyed, first of all, our show tonight. And it just basically tells you the balance of flower life is just on the edge every day. And I think we all realize that. And, you know, as far as transportation, I think still aviation is probably the most safe form of transportation. Any disagreements with that?
Nope. I tell my friends the same thing. When a crash comes, I keep saying, how many people die in automobile accidents and how many people die in airplane accidents? Of course, airplane accidents are very, very tragic, and they're very explosive. But I have to agree with you, 100%. It's the safest way to travel.
Steve,
I'll second
and,
that.
Yeah. Steve, you and Glenda, I'm sure, think back often. I know I would if it had been me. I would think back often to that Flight 663. Eastern Flight 663. And you know the Captain Carson of that flight did everything in his power to avoid that accident. And
yeah, there was one
that,
thing, Neil, that the accident report I don't think addressed is that in the DC-7, the artificial horizon was a different type than what we have today. And that artificial horizon, once you got past 90 degrees, it would tumble.
Yeah.
And it would make itself useless then thereafter.
Yeah.
So here you had no horizon. He had no horizon and no artificial horizon in the cockpit that he could refer to. Whereas in today's airplanes, with the electronic artificial horizon, it is good through a 360-degree turn.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, having flown the 757, which also was the same as the 767 as far as the systems were concerned and type rating, indicated to me that that airplane, and I'm sure they improved in the version 777, the fact that that airplane continuously trimmed itself. It was an automatic trim system that that airplane generated. And no matter what the airplane was, you know, I remember a flight that I had back from Seattle to Atlanta, nonstop from Seattle, and we were at 41,000 feet. We were positioning the airplane. In other words, it was not a revenue flight. And I had a few deadheading crew members, including a crew member from another airline and his son that wanted to get back to Atlanta. And because it wasn't a passenger flight, I asked the pilot of the other airline to bring his son up front and fly the 757. And at 41,000 feet, which we were cruising back to Atlanta, the young man that was, I think, the best I can recall, was about 13 years old, flew the airplane without an autopilot at 41,000 feet, and the airplane was just as smooth and also trimmed to realize where it should be. And I, you know, when I think about the 777. And how it must have improved since the 757, 767 days, I'm sure that that airplane could have flown itself. And according to the generated path that was introduced by the pilots on that flight. But, you know, the Boeing, I just have all respect for Boeing airplanes. I flew a lot of them. And I'm sure all of the Eastern people did, too, because we were strong supporters of Boeing aircraft. Well, anything else? Yeah.
Yes, Neil, it's Cecile here. All I got to say is we've come a long way since the Wright brothers, or possibly Charlie Ripley. It might have been a French guy or a German guy that invented the plane a couple of days before the Wright brothers. So, anyway, we've come a long way, and it is the safest mode of
transportation. George?
Well, yeah, there was a, I don't know if anybody reads it, but there's a blog called Flying Lessons by Christine Negroni. She used to work for Kreinler, and she left there, and now she has her own website. And I thought it was one of the most interesting scenarios that I've read, and Christine feels that perhaps it was hypoxia that caused the problems on the Malaysian flight, that, you know, nothing was done purposely, but that there might have been the crew might have been, and perhaps the passengers might have had oxygen starvation, which would fit in basically with what you stated about, you know, the flying characteristics of the airplane. But that was probably the most interesting take that I've seen on it, and you know, because it's very subtle, and also it would explain a lot of the otherwise inexplicable things that went on here. You know, for example, we know that if a terrorist, one of the things that they like to do is advertise in order to place terror in everybody's heart, yet none of that took place here. But you might want to take a look at that at Christine's blog. It's excellent. I'm on the mailing list for it, and it was a pretty interesting take on it.
What was it again, George?
It's Flying Lessons. It's Christine Negroni, Negroni. She is the blog master. I'm sure if you
hey,
know
I'll
her name,
take a look.
Google, you can see it.
Sounds interesting.
Yeah.
Let's remember to say a prayer for the family.
Absolutely. And guys and gal, it's been great, our show tonight, and we think of those flights that Eastern had and all of the family that we call Eastern family that lost their lives flying Eastern airplanes. We think of them just as we think of Flight 663 that we talked about tonight. And we would like to thank again Steve and Glenda Thompson, who experienced that dramatic the dramatic flight of Flight 663. But because we've got our champagne music in the background, we must bring this show to a close. And from all of our hosts, it's been a great night tonight being with you. And we hope that you will continue listening to the voice of Eastern Airlines Radio throughout the year. And so from all of us here at the EAL Radio Show, until next week, keep the blue side up, have plenty of airspeed, plenty of altitude, and may all your landings be smooth as grease. Grease jobs, we call them. Good night, Eastern family.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.